Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Off the Record. I'm your host, Jordan Runtog. Thanks so much for listening. Our latest chapter covered David Bowie's creative renaissance in the 90s and early 2000s. It was a fascinating period for David, as he turned his back on the mainstream commercial success he'd earned with his 1983 smash Let's Dance, an album that made him a mainstay on corporate music television. By veering away from the middle of the road, he freed himself of the expectations and demands of mass appeal, and got back to doing what he wanted. The records that he made in this period are often overlooked, but rank among the most experimental of his career. He rejoined formative 70s collaborators like Brian Eno and Tony Visconti. Together, they'd create some of the most daring music David ever made. But one crucial collaborator during this period was new to Bowie's circle. Her name is Gail Ann Dorsey, and she's one of my all-time bass-playing idols. If you've ever heard her duet with Bowie on Under Pressure, then you'll know exactly why. Born and raised in Philadelphia, Gail studied film at CalArts before returning to her first love of music. She moved to London in the early 80s, where she pursued her dream. Over the years, she's worked with everyone from Lenny Kravitz, Gang of Four, and Olivia Newton-John, to Boy George, Tears for Fears, and the Indigo Girls, not to mention her own incredible solo work. Definitely check out her 1988 debut LP called The Corporate World. Her partnership with Bowie began with a call out of the blue, something of a theme with David. It was 1995, and he was looking for a bassist to join the tour to promote One Outside. David had seen Gail performing on British television 7 years earlier, and he'd never forgotten her. He just had a feeling, and that feeling was right on the money. She accompanied him on every tour for the rest of his life, and played on the albums Earthling, Reality, and most thrillingly, his secret comeback record The Next Day. My conversation with Gail was a joy. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. I guess taking it all the way back to the beginning, was there a moment when you knew music was what you wanted to do with your life, or did it happen slowly?
Oh, I knew it from the very beginning. I just innately knew it. I don't know why or how, but I knew that was... When I heard music, it just made perfect sense to me, basically, from the earliest of ages. I was singing or wanting an instrument. No, I knew it. And I just knew that I couldn't really conceive of doing anything else in the world. Like, the older I got, even through, like, you know, my teenage years or even before that, I just thought, when I'm a grown-up, I have to play music. Like, all the people I listen to and see on TV and go to concerts, I was like, that's where I belong, and I don't know how I'm going to make it, but I have to, because I just knew there was no alternative. I really did.
And you grew up in Philadelphia in the early 70s, and it's hard to think of a better place for a music lover to be at that place at that
time.
Absolutely.
I'm a very proud Philadelphian, and I really have a great memory of the city, of my time growing up in that city. I just think it was such a rich musical environment at that time. When I think back on it now, I just go, wow, what an oasis. That, you know, just the way it was kind of permeating. I mean, music still is an integral part of our culture and our life. We can't survive. It's like water and air. We need it to live. We really do. But that was just a time when music was just still growing, and it was more kind of organic, and in the sense that it wasn't... So technologically driven. We were talking about technology earlier, and I think there was something to be said for lack of finding ways to do things. So music was so innovative at that time, I think. So it was a great education, a great exciting time for music.
And you were the youngest in your family. Did your older siblings turn you on the stuff from a little before your time? I know you've mentioned Cream and Grand Funk Railroad. Who else did they really get you into?
Yeah, well, that's where it started. I mean, they were the ones that had the record player before I got there, you know, and they were bringing records into the house, and everybody's playing music in the neighborhood. But in our house, it was all the hand-me-down albums from my sister and brothers, and one of my older brothers was a real, he, you know, dabbled in music. He played congas, he played upright bass for a minute. He dabbled with guitar. He loved music. So he had a tape recorder with the little reels on it, like the Mission Impossible, the old tiny little cassette reels, and the microphone that plugs in, and you know, a little plastic microphone. And he would let me sing in it. And that was like, once that happened, that was really another, like a big epiphany. I was like, oh, for sure, I've got to do this. I heard my voice come back on the machine. I was like, oh my God, this is it. this is what I have to do this. But they brought a lot of different music. That was the beauty of that time. The music was very different. So many, you know, they were listening to things from bands like Cold Blood, which were kind of these kind of white bands that were kind of soulful, like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, you know, those type of bands, Rare Earth, that kind of stuff. And then there was Earth, Wind, and Fire, of course. And then their early days, they were kind of jazzy. They weren't so pop. So there was all these different, you know, elements. And then, you know, I would always say, I don't know when my brothers, something must have fallen off the back of a truck. You know, they'd come home with some weird album. That's how we used to put it. I was like, where'd you get that? You know, the first drumsticks I got, my brother came home and said, here's these. And there was like these drumsticks that I ended up beating on everything with. But I was like, where did they come from? Oh, off the back of the truck. But this was the saying. But I remember my first Partridge Family was one of those albums from off the back of a truck, which actually the TV show was on, which I loved watching. But when I put on that first Partridge Family album, it was like, wow. The Wrecking Crew, all that yeah. music, that was the music I really, really, really loved. Because it was on the radio. My mother listened to AM radio all the time. It's always on in the kitchen, and it had all that music, Partridge Family, Carpenters, Carole King, like all the sort of early singer-songwriters. So music was handed down to me, and I just absorbed it all, including, you know, Cream. There would be Cream. My brothers listened to Led Zeppelin and listened to, you know, Jimi Hendrix. It was across the board. It wasn't sort of polarized as it is now. There's a lot of mixture of stuff.
What kind of impact did the band Heart have on you?
Huge. Because I was at that, by the time they came out in 75-ish, really, Magic Man, 75, 76, I had my first electric guitar, and I had started a little band with a couple of boys that lived across the street, bass and drums. So we were like a Grand Funk trio. And I don't know why, I don't know where the Grand Funk albums came from, but they were one of my favorite. In fact, that was the guitar, Mark Farner's guitar. He was one of my first guitar heroes. I was like, that guy could play guitar like nobody's business.
Yeah.
It was so soulful and funky and I listened to those. Oh, so I was kind of trying to imitate that. I've never come close, but on guitar anyway. But, you know, I had a band with these guys, and then, there weren't many role models for me, you know, certainly not in the black community anyway, black artists. There was Taste of Honey came out with Boogie Oogie, you know, with two black women with a bass and a guitar, but it wasn't really what I was hoping to do in the future. So all of a sudden, Heart comes out, and I see Nancy Wilson. She was playing acoustic, but she was also playing electric sometimes, and they were rocking out, like Zeppelin, but to me, and better. I don't know. I like Led Zeppelin, but they're kind of more of a macho boy band to me. and Heart was a good sort of in between. They were no pussies. But they weren't like, you know, they had a female touch, and it was so soulful. And Ann Wilson to this day to me is the greatest female rock singer that I've ever heard. I'll put it that way. So they had a huge impact. They're like my second favorite band of all time. I wore their records out all the way through the 80s and still listen to them and got to meet them and just love them.
Aww.
So that was a big, because it just made me feel like I could do it. When I saw Nancy Wilson up there, like Kick It Out, you know, all those great stuff, Little Queen, I said, yeah, I can do this.
Yes.
Women are allowed to do this, you know.
You mentioned playing guitar. How did you make the jump to bass?
Just to get work. Like, yeah. I think if you talk to a lot of bass players, they say the same thing, that they stumbled onto the bass because people needed somebody to play the bass because it wasn't really cool. It wasn't as cool as it is now in terms of an instrument that people, you know, everybody played the guitar, you know, it was about being a guitar god, or maybe a drummer. But bass was always this thing that people used to say when I remember when I was young. They were like, well, you can't. I don't even know what the bass is doing. I can't hear it. You know, it's like, really? You know what I mean? It's like they perceived that it was this thing in the background that just kind of was there, like mumbling away while everything else was up front. Because usually in a band, unless it was Thin Lizzy or with the Motorhead or Sting when he came along, which was a little later on in the game. But in the early days, it was like the bass was kind of in the background. Now, at this point in my life, as being known as a bass player and all the years I've played the bass, it is the most important. It is really the most important instrument, I think, in an ensemble, what the bass represents, whether it's coming from a guitar or a left hand of a keyboard or synth or whatever, a tuba, whatever's assuming that role is in charge.
It's the heartbeat.
It's in charge of, like, harmonically and emotionally and just the direction of where a piece of music goes. It really changed. Once the bass comes in, you might think you don't hear it, but you certainly feel it.
You feel, and you know when it's not there. I feel like that's, like, a really crucial part.
Well, exactly. The whole earth changes. It's like a shift. It's like free fall. And then when it comes back, it's grounded and it's taking you in whatever the next direction is, whether it's playing the root note or some kind of substitution. If it screws up
you know
on something, you know immediately, you know, when you start making those mistakes on stage, you are like, it was most, that's like, you know, getting an electric jolt. You're like, oh dear, warning. So you know, and you start, that's like your biggest fear for me still, really, is always my biggest fear, you know, because I'm still not always like it. You know, I'm no Nathan East or whatever who can really just randomly play a song from top to bottom and never not going to hit a wrong note. You know, I'm going to have to figure it out first. So it usually takes me time, unless it's something very simple.
What was your first bass that you ever had or you ever played? You remember?
It was an Epiphone, which I no longer have, but I have pictures of it, and I don't even know. I should actually send it to someone at Epiphone if they could tell me what that model is. I have never, ever seen it again. But I recently, when my mother passed away about 10 years ago now, an old friend, interestingly enough, who had something to do with me becoming a bass player, she was the best friend of my sister. My sister was 7 years older than me. When I went for my first bass audition to get a job in a top 40 band, which was to find work, which is why I decided, I borrowed a bass, and it was from her boyfriend that I borrowed a bass to go to this audition. And then I said to my mother, if I get the job, I was 15, I think, 14 or 15. So if I get the job, will you buy me a bass? And she said, yeah, sure. She didn't think I'd get the job. So I got the job in the summer, like in between school, with a guy who was older. He was 18 or 19 at the time. He became a lifelong friend, funny enough. And I used her boyfriend's Rickenbacker. And then, my mother had to buy me a bass, and she bought me that Epiphone bass. And then my friend, whose boyfriend's bass I borrowed, when she came to my mother's funeral these many years later, she brought me a little stack of photographs she took of me with that Epiphone bass, because I didn't know they existed. I don't remember. I posed like I was a rock star on a car. I think that you can see them on Facebook, you know, my little afro and my little corduroy pants, you know, sort of my 70s. And I'm standing in the middle of the street like I'm somebody, you know, with my bass or leaning on a Grand Torino or something, you know.
Like your Lemmy in Thin Lizzy or something
posing,
with the Rick.
You know? Yeah, I was posing in my Epiphone bass. And so it was so funny how she was the one that had that, and it came around that many years later. She said, I think you're going to want these pictures.
Oh, that's so special. So
they're all faded and everything. Yeah, so that my first bass was an Epiphone. And I when I went away to college to do screenwriting and make movies, I just gave it to some. I don't even know where it went. You know, when you're young, you say, oh, okay, now I'm doing this. But not that I wanted to give up music, but I definitely had a strong interest in film. I still love film. I don't have a lot of time to spend on it anymore, but I'd like to watch more films, but with all the streaming and everything,
yeah, it's almost
endless.
Overwhelming.
It's endless. It's too overwhelming. You know, I miss the days of, okay, waiting for the next film, go to the theater, pace yourself.
What brought you back to music after going to CalArts to study screenwriting? What made you to return after sort of, it seems like you were on such a path in Philadelphia and these bands and things. What sort of brought you back after going off to school?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it was the industry of film that I discovered just through school. I mean, obviously I never worked in the movies or anything. But it was the experience of the men in film school at that time. I was like, I'm not going to survive in this business because I can't put up with that.
Yeah.
I can't put up with being disrespected or ignored or mistreated in that way. And it was nothing sexual, but it was not. I was the only female in my freshman class in 1980.
Wow.
This was 1980. Now it would be a whole different story. I'm sure there's women all over the place, which it should have been. But at that time, it wasn't. And that didn't dawn on me because this is my first time away from home. I'm 17 or 18. Never been on a plane. I go from Philadelphia to Van Nuys Airport, and you know, a little bus picks me up and takes me to CalArts. I'm in college all of a sudden. And then I go to my class, and a lot of the guys, because CalArts was not a traditional university, but you could still get a bachelor's degree. You didn't do math and science and all that. It had like these critical studies, and then it was art 5 days a week. It was just all about whatever school you were in. So, you know, the basic production class is what you start with, and the film live action is just sort of one semester of like this thing where you learn like the basics of filming itself. So you do each job, you boom operator, you learn how to load the 16mm camera, you have your little editing suite, like you learn the basics of everything, lighting and NAGRA sound, just so you have to work amongst yourselves. And a lot of the guys also, it wasn't structured that if people were just coming out of high school. They were, some of the guys in the class had worked already in a TV station in Puerto Rico, or somebody was from Germany, and they already had, they were 20 or 25, you know, so it was a mixture of people in the class. And I think there was only one other black guy, if I recall. And I didn't exist. Like no one would want to work with me. They wouldn't want, we were supposed to be on each other's film shoots. No one would hire me.
That's awful.
I was just ignored. And then I saw what they were doing. Like they were going down to Hollywood and stuff and trying to make little movies. And, you know, they were really ambitious. And when I saw the level of what they would do to get something done, and what they would do to someone it's like they would sell their grandmother to make, you know, it's like, I thought, you know what? I was like, this is not the industry. I didn't imagine it to be this way, you know, as a kid dreaming in West Philly. And I was like, if it's going to be like this, I have not got time for this. And I dropped out. I remember going to the dean in tears. I said, they won't hire me. They won't. And then something happened, which was so funny. Is that at the very end of the year when one of the guys was shooting a film down in Hollywood, like not in the school grounds, but he had some friends and they were going to shoot some kind of crime scene or something in somebody's flat in Hollywood. And he knocked on my editing door, one of the directors, one of the snotty guys, you know, and he said, I'm shooting this film down in the city in the weekend, and the person who was going to do continuity, basically script girl, you know, that kind of job,
yeah.
has bailed on me. And I guess you're free. You know, they knew I was free, of course. You know, everybody else was working on everybody else's things. And I was trying to find somebody who would work with me. So I was hanging out with the theater students and playing music in the cafe. Anyway, so I took the job. I said, yeah, I'll come and do it. And I happen to have four houses in Virgo. I'm a Scorpio, but I'm so anal. I'm very precise. I can't help it. I'm a little OCD. So I go down and I get my, I know what the job is because I've studied it. And I'm like, okay, this is what you do. And you make a log from the film to the sound person. You got to load the clappers. You got to take the Polaroids. I have my camera, take pictures of the actors, make sure the cigarette's in the right hand, you know, all that shit. So I do it and I write all my notes down. I know how to do the charts. I have the forms and everything. Give it to the director at the end of the shoot and then they go off and they edit and they use my notes. So they know they like take 7, but they like take 3 of that one and then like, et cetera. A week later, I'm flooded with people who want me to be do continuity on this shoot. The director knocks on my door because I used to hang out in my editing room down in the sub-level, we called it. We all had those rooms with the Steinbeck where, you know, and the little film that I did make, you know, I would just sort of roll it around and around and just, or just sit down there and smoke some weed or something. I don't know what I was doing. Anyway, so they knocked on the door and said, you know, this is the best film notes, editing notes I've ever had. It's the easiest time for me to edit my film. This is amazing. It's so precise. So then I was suddenly script girl, you know, for everybody, which was funny. They all liked me then.
It's
and then it was too late because I was like, I'm out of here. Not the industry for me, not that level anyway. I'm sure I would love to have a great idea and great, write a good script that gets made one of these days. But that was another thing, was like screenwriting. I enjoyed writing when I was a kid and I still like to write a bit. And I just felt like I need, for me as a person and as an artist, I need more feedback. And I found film to be a lonely thing in a sense that you work, especially screenwriting, because you write this piece that you work on for a year or however long, or maybe shorter or longer, and then it takes years for someone to make it. It's possible that it will take years, many years, before it's made, and it gets revised, and it's like this, and then it gets made, and then they want to change it. And like, so there's all this. I thought, I need more. I can't wait that long to get some kind of affirmation of something from someone experiencing my work. You know what I mean?
Oh, so is this, when you give the script away, it's somebody else's vision too when you see it up on the screen too. So that's got to feel, that can't feel good.
No, well, that's what I meant. I mean, and I would love to have directed. I would like to be the double barrel, you know, the writer-director kind of thing. But, you know, it was, I just knew that the way that, what I felt of the industry that I could experience through my experience with film school at CalArts at that time, I'm sure it's really different now. In fact, I know it is. It was just not, I just didn't want to work in that. I just couldn't exist in that way. And then, of course, it would be a matter of time before that sort of, you know, attitude towards me turns into other things, the sexual thing and all that. It's like, I just couldn't deal with it. And it's been, and so music, I was like, I'm going to go back and play music. And then with, at least with music, you stand on a stage and you play and you get immediate, you know, feedback and response from what you're giving. And that, and once that happens, I mean, that's the magic for me of life. Those are the moments I am most comfortable being in my skin as a human being on this planet, is when I can walk on a stage, big or small, you know, 10 people, 10 million people, whatever, you know, however many, and just have that connection. It's like my meditation. It's the only time my brain is empty of all the things that are destroying me at other times. You know, so it's been in that respect, this year has been really difficult. The past year has been super hard. Not just for me, but a lot of my peers.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the people who want to experience what we can offer or what we have to offer. I mean, it's all what we give. I feel like music and artists in general, it's just we're giving the thing that's missing the most in the world, and that's love. You know, what we give is this sort of what I would describe as a large love, you know, like not love being in love, but just like positivity, you know, and we need to get that back very soon. We need to get that exchange going, pumped out into the world again very, very soon, or we're in big danger.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and not through a screen, and not through a screen. We can't live like this through these screens. We can't.
No.
That's going to destroy us as well, I believe. eventually. So we got to get out there and connect with the people again, with music and dance and things that bring that level of good vibration up in people's spirits.
Oh my gosh, I know. It's just so fascinating to me to think that, you know, when we see remnants of early human civilizations from times when we're still just struggling to eat and survive, you see traces of, mm-hmm. of musical instruments. So clearly this is a base human need from, you know, and we don't know why. I love that. I just love that the mystery of music, like we don't know where it came from. Or,
yes,
I love that.
I know. I was seeing that I was watched a little bit of the Fran Lebowitz. Are you familiar mm-hmm. with her? The writer that's on Netflix or Hulu or one of those things. I don't know which one. At the moment, she's doing a thing with Scorsese where she's just kind of ranting about New York City, which she does so brilliantly.
Yes.
I love her. But she said a thing about music on one of the episodes, and I was just sobbing because she really hit it. She's like, there's no other art form that can touch a person and change them instantly in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
From one, like, can take you and transport you, and you don't know why. And it's true, and I was just thought, oh, my God, it is. It really is a special, magical thing. And I personally feel so incredibly, like, that's what's so weird, just like knowing as a kid that I needed to be a vessel for that. I don't know why, but I still feel like I'm just like, I'm here to do. I don't have anything else really. I mean, I have things to offer, but you know what I mean? That's the best I can offer, put it that way. That is the best of me, is to keep allowing the gift I've been given to channel that energy into the earth, into people, into the world as best I can, you know?
I love that line from the Fran Lebowitz documentary. It's such a unique art form for that reason. I mean, I learned music as a kid because I loved it, and I wanted to see if maybe if I learned how to make those sounds myself, I would understand why it made me feel that way.
That's it.
And it never happened to me. It's just I still don't understand why I put my hand here and it's an F major 7th chord and it makes me feel warm or something. Mm-hmm. And I just still don't. It's vibrational.
Exactly.
It's vibrational. That's the best I can say.
It is. And vibration is everything. It really is. Vibration is everywhere. It's important. Very important. We can't see it, but it's a huge force.
It's very present.
In all of us. Yeah.
Just thinking about the convergence of different kinds of art forms, did studying film with the narrative and the visual elements and the costuming and everything that entails, including music, perhaps prepare you in some ways for going on tour with David Bowie? Because obviously that was such a huge element mm-hmm. for him.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot because he knew that I'd gone to film school. And at one point, he used to call me, I'm the little documentarian. You know, I shot a lot of film, a lot of video stuff, but he would just allow me to kind of film a bunch of stuff sometimes. And there's one thing that we were on Rosie O'Donnell for the Earthling album, I think. You can find it somewhere maybe on YouTube. I don't know where. I've seen it once or twice. Where she always asked him to sing China Girl to her, and he would never do it. And they were good friends. He was really good friends with Rosie O'Donnell, him and Iman both. And he wanted me to film a high eight, because at the time it was like high eight tape, videotape. He wanted me to film him singing China Girl in the chair on her, talking to Rosie on the guitar. He was going to surprise her. And then take the tape out of the machine and give it to her as a gift. And I do it. I'm on the screen. And she's like wondering where I've come from. And all of a sudden I'm up on the stand, you know, filming him. And then he starts singing China Girl. And then he says, give me the tape. And I give him the tape and he presents it to Rosie. But the whole film thing was, yeah, we talked, like he knew I liked film. So it was a nice subject that we had to talk about sometimes. And he always, you know, encouraged me to make movies and take pictures and he thought that was very cool. He liked anybody who was kind of into loads of things like that, especially I'm not an avid reader. I'm not as big a reader as he is. He's a huge reader. But, you know, like Reeves Gabrels, for example, was on his level with that kind of thing. And they would go on and on about books all day and have all these great references. So, I mean, yeah, I think film school did help in some way. Certainly theater, like being around the theater school helped me a lot, which was another facet of CalArts. They have five different schools of art, so they're all kind of intertwined. But I hung around with a lot of actors, and just the whole kind of stage presence thing was helped me a little bit with getting there with David. But I feel like with David, he really was another university. I mean, he was another level of me, of like a mentor for many aspects, for my visual aspects, like, you know, what to wear, how to be on stage, just, you know, and not even by saying much, but just by, he knew I was watching, you know what I mean? He was kind of demonstrating without words in some ways. And he would guide me in more of a physical sense, not, you know, like just, or not physical and kind of cosmic kind of stuff. You know, he would be like, watch this kind of, like, this is where we're going to go, you know, kind of check this out. And I was just absorbing it all like a sponge. It was really, you know, he was kind of very much another level of learning to be a professional and or whatever that means, I guess, in that sense, you know, of be a good performer.
It's hard to think of a less inhibited artist. I mean, that must have been incredible to see and to for you to grow as well, to have that example in front of you.
Oh, my God. I don't, you know, that was, and it came out of left field. It wasn't, you know, I was a Bowie fan. I would love to have been in one of his bands, but I used to think, because I think I said to my friend Louise Goffin, I was like, man, I would love to play for David Bowie or somebody like that. Because to me, there's like I was saying this to another journalist the other day about David and someone like what's his name, Frank Zappa, or those kind of people. Like when you're in one of those bands, like you're like the shit. Like that's like and you know, like it's one of those bands that you come out of that someone's like, oh, he played for or she played for so and so. That's like to reach that. I used to think I would never reach that. You know, I thought, okay, I can play with other people. I'm never going to reach that level where I'm like Steve Vai or something. You know, it's like, so that was like to be invited to that out of nowhere was like, oh my God, I had no idea what was happening. I was just like, I can't believe this is happening. So I dropped everything I was doing and went for it. And it was the best decision I've ever made, I guess, certainly in terms of my career so far.
And it really was out of the blue. It was a phone call?
A phone call out of the blue. He said he saw me on a television show in the late 80s. He didn't call me till 95. But knowing him, I know why he won't forget. His photographic memory, even with all those drugs and alcohol, he can remember absolutely everything. I can't remember last week. It's crazy. It's like, so, you know, and he could remember every little detail. So if something sparked him, if something he liked, he's not going to forget it. Or something he thinks he can use later on, because that's what I was. He said, I saw you on a TV show. He was in London flipping channels and I came on, thank God. Wow. Stopped on a music program. And I was on a music program with my first album on a major label. I was on Warner Brothers, WEA in the UK and Sire in the US. And I did the corporate world and I was doing all the TV shows in London to promote the album. And I was on, he said, you spoke to the host. And then you went and you played a song with your band or on my own. I don't know. A lot of times it was just me and my guitarist. And then I'd go and he said, I just thought that woman is really interesting. When I'm doing the right project, I would love to work with her.
Wow.
That was what he said he thought to himself in 19. It had to have been 89, no later than 90. Because I was already like left and going to Ireland and taking a year off and So it would have been then. And then he calls me for the outside tour. Why he would have thought that was the right time, I have no idea. But it not only was the right time, I managed to work there until 2013 or whatever. Wow. Till the next day. I remained the bass player. Amazing.
How did David in the flesh compare to the image that you must have had of him in your head beforehand?
That's an interesting question. Well, much more, I guess a lot of people might say this about, well, maybe I don't know what they say about other artists, to be honest, in that way. Much more normal. I imagine it'd be a bit more freaky, but also I feel like I got him at a particular age where he wasn't going to be like a total freak, like you would imagine, you know, like you imagine he was when he's the thin white Duke and Ziggy, you know, with all the skinny and the pale face and the hair and the, you know, lipstick or whatever. I knew he wasn't going to be like that every day. Whereas I have to say, I wouldn't know that about Prince. I never worked for Prince, but I imagine he might look like he looks every day. I don't know, you know. But David was like just a normal guy, really. He was a normal British guy, attractive man. But especially when I first started working with him, he was he had a lot of energy. He always did have energy. Didn't wane till the very. It didn't wane ever. But he was more. He was. I think I marveled at his. Maybe not his physical energy I'm speaking of, but I marveled at his ability to be just thinking of new ideas like all the time. He was on his whole brain was on autopilot all the time, just with all these great ideas. Everything he saw a million possibilities in it. You could see it in his eyes. You know, he would look at one thing and you'd know that 5,000 things would flash through his mind what he could do with that thing, you know, and then he turned his head over that way and you could just see it. He had this uncanny, that was something that was amazing about him in the flesh that I couldn't have known, you couldn't know from watching on maybe a little bit, but, you know, seeing him on a chat show or something or on stage.
I was lucky enough to speak to one of his producers, Ken Scott, who'd worked with him on Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane. And he mentioned how Bowie was just so incredibly gifted at putting groups together and getting this sort of creative alchemy where he could choose just the right people.
That's it. That was his greatest gift.
Yeah.
And it's an underrated, like people don't even realize how important that gift is. That is his greatest gift. That's what makes it even more amazing to be chosen as one of the colors on his palette.
Mm.
You know, it's like, cause he knows exactly how to put the right mixture together. And that has been his gift from day one, because it's not, he's the most amazing front man in the world, but he's not, you know, it's not like he's a musical virtuoso or, you know, he's an incredible songwriter. That's without question. But it's like as a sort of instrumentalist or whatever, that's, you know, it's the voice, which you can't, you know, deny. He's one of the greatest singers I've ever heard. Right up there with like Sinatra or somebody, but an incredible singer. You know, he put together the right things around him to always elevate his idea of what he wanted to personify for himself. And that is really difficult. You can't imagine how difficult that can be, you know, for a lot of artists.
And you've toured with Lenny Kravitz, and I know he was very particular about your bass sound, saying, okay, I want a vintage P bass to give it that funk attitude. Was David that specific about what he wanted musically, or did he leave you to it to do what you do best?
Not at all. Never even mentioned. He never ever said a single word in, I don't know, 15 years or whatever, how many years, about what instrument I was playing or not playing. Never. Not once. He didn't
That's
care.
That's so cool. That's so
as long
cool.
As long as you played what he wanted, as long as he was enjoying singing, and it wasn't even like he was listening, you know, unlike Lenny would be, or some other artists, not just Lenny, would be listening to what you're playing, like what everybody's playing. They go, oh no, that drum beat is not right. Well, you don't play that little bit too hard, or can you, can you not do a fill there, or can you do a fill there, or you know, like some people are listening to all of those elements, you know, all the guitars, you know, too strummy, you should do it more with a pick. So he would come in and listen and sing. And if he didn't feel good, like you could tell if you were doing as an ensemble, if you were doing the right thing, because you would see him smiling and enjoying himself singing. And if he wasn't enjoying himself singing, you knew you weren't quite doing the right thing, and he wouldn't tell you what the right thing was. You would just find it. But after a while, you know exactly what he's going to enjoy. You just learn. You learn it, and because you know what you enjoy, like you discover. Like he chooses all these different people, and amongst each other, you discover the beauty that you discover your own beauty that you make with these people as a band, not just with him singing, but just what you do musically. So you're learning that as well. Like you're learning how to fit into this configuration that he's made. And then when you start seeing how beautiful it is or what blossoms, and you don't even, and again, you don't know why. Even I've never played with Earl Stick, or I might have never played with Sterling, or I never, you know, heard of, you know, so-and-so. But I walk in and I'm like, wow, this sounds incredible. How is that possible? And easily too, not so difficultly. Like everybody seems to know. And what it is that everybody's just doing what they do.
Yeah.
So then it goes back to his choice. Like no one's trying to do anything except do the best thing they can do because they're in David Bowie's freaking band. So you're doing whatever you can do. You're doing at the height of your, like you are like on hyperdrive to do the best you can do at what you do because he's not telling you what he wants. Do you know what I'm saying? He's not telling you, he's telling you what song to play. And he might say, I don't want to do it like we used to do it. I don't want to do it like the record. Like maybe change the beat or something. And he'll let you figure out what you might, how you might interpret it. Especially on the first tour when he wasn't doing the hits. He wanted to do things that would do. And if he did the hits, like Man Who Sold the World, he wanted to do a drum and bass version. Well, you better figure it out.
Was that intimidating?
Not all the time. Sometimes in the beginning, yeah. In the beginning, I was terrified. In the beginning, I was terrified. But then I learned to trust that he trusted me. He believed in me more than I believed in myself. I don't know how the other musicians felt, but I know that he did. And he really pushed me sometimes. And then I surprised myself. I will be forever indebted to him for that. I am so grateful to him for that. This is the greatest thing, the greatest gift you could give to another musician or an artist. You know, he always said, you know, like you've seen it in interviews maybe, like stay out of your, when you're out of your comfort zone, you're in the right spot. the moment you're comfortable, you might as well not even be bothering. And he was the living proof of that. He always stretched himself, like each time it was some new, like he was going out on a limb. And he loved it. He loved the ride. It was like a roller coaster for him. He was laughing all the way. people might have been criticizing or whatever. He didn't give a shit. He was having he wanted to enjoy what he was doing, and he made sure that happened. And he brought that joy to all of us. And I'm it was an incredible job. It's an incredible experience in my life. Priceless.
I mean, for me, the best example of getting out of your comfort zone personally, I love your version of Under Pressure, especially the one at Glastonbury.
You.
It's in 2000.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell me how that came together? Because I know Queen were, you mentioned Heart being your second favorite band. Queen were your number one, or are your number one, right?
That's right. Still are, yep. Oh, man, that was freaky. I mean, I never even imagined, because I just thought we would never do that song. When I got, you know, it never occurred to me. When I got the job with Bowie, that we would even ever do that song. Because I thought, well, we'll never do Under Pressure because Freddie Mercury's dead and he doesn't sing with other people. You know, who was going to do that song with him in the show? Because we didn't have singers like that, you know, in the show. And then, sure enough, like, kind of in the early weeks, I was still on the Nine Inch Nails tour, I remember that, because we started doing it way back early, in the early days, 96. I remember him coming into my dressing room, I think it was before a show would have been, and he came in and he had a cassette tape of the version he did with Andy Lennox at Freddie's memorial concert at Wembley Stadium. And which was stunning. I have a photograph of that on my wall in my little bedroom studio. I just love that. It was such a special moment. And I love Annie Lennox too. And I didn't know him yet then. He said to me, asked me if I remembered that time. And I said, of course I do. And he said, well, I was thinking about doing that song in the show, like, you know, like I did it with Annie. And I said, well, who's gonna play? So he was like, would you think about singing it? And I said, well, yeah, my goodness. But I said, who's gonna play the bass? Because I thought we'd do it like Andy Lennox as well, and you know, I would actually perform it with him, you know, in his arms or whatever. However they did it, or I would be performing it and somebody else would be playing the bass. And he said, no, you're gonna play the bass. I said, and singing at the same time. Right, you know, and then he looked at me and he just put a very cheeky look and he just went, I'll give you 2 weeks. And he put the cassette down and he walked out of the room.
No pressure. Oh, man.
Talk about under pressure, right?
Yeah, right.
So I just drilled it for 2 weeks until I figured it out. See, that's a perfect example. That was the biggest and most important example. It was like the earliest exam I passed. It was like exam number one. If you get through this one, you know, you're good for a good 10 years. So I was like, oh, my God, I got the hardest SAT in the first round. You know,
oh,
whatever.
God.
So he gave me that job, and I went to my hotel room every day, and I put it in my cassette player and whatever I had, and I studied it and put a metronome down, and I did it slow, and I did it fast, until I figured it out. And he asked me one day, you think you're ready to try it in soundcheck? And I was like, yep, let's go. Let's do it. Let's try it. You know, I can't put it off any longer. And the rest is history. It's changed my life doing that song. And then the association with Freddie, because I used to ask him, I know they were friends, and I used to ask him to please tell me stories about Freddie. And the only one he would tell me was that he was very fun. He said, you would have loved him. And he said, every time you turn up at his house, he would always open the door and he'd be in full drag and he'd have opera blaring out really loud around the house. But and it's funny when he said that, when I saw the film, I was like, oh, it's just like David said. He said, you turn up and say hi, you know, to hang out with Freddie. He opens the front door and he's just like a woman, and the opera is so loud it takes your head off.
That's everything I ever wanted him to be. I'm so glad that that is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I told him how much I love Freddie. So he was like, Freddie would be really proud. When he told me Freddie, I mean, everybody tells me Freddie would be proud. And really, that is the only thing that was the most important thing I wanted to do. I obviously didn't want to like suck in front of David, but I did not want to let Freddie's legacy down, because that was he really was the greatest performer I've ever seen in my life to this day. That the whole band in their original form in the late 70s, early 80s, I've never seen anything like it out of four human beings ever. That music drives me mad. It's so incredible. And the power and the force that came from those four guys was just unimaginable.
What were sessions like for the next day? Because I know not only were they top secret, but you were in the midst of dates with, I think, Lenny Kravitz and Olivia Newton-John. What was that experience like?
I was. Yeah, I was busy. Well, it was hard. Initially, you know, I just went in to do the early tracks, the bass tracks. Yes, it was a secret. He caught, again, there was a long period of time after the reality tour, of course, where he had his health issues. And he just went home to be home and get healthy and be with his family. I know he was really missing. His daughter was really little then. He was missing her. I could tell. Because it was all, you know, just Skyping every day or whatever. It's not the same, as we know.
Yeah, yes, yes.
So as we've come to know. And he, I kept in touch with him a little bit regularly by email. Just, you know, he asked if I'd seen a movie. I remember we emailed when Alexander McQueen left us and stuff like that. So, because he'd done a lot of our clothes in the 90s. So he called me again out of the blue. I think it was like in 2009 or 10, because, yeah, it was in 2010. 2010, maybe 2011 even. And I was really busy, but he was like, I'm going to do this album. You know, what are you up to? Like, so I thought, okay, he's been thinking of something. I didn't know. I never knew he was going to come back. You know, I never know. I knew he'd do something, but I didn't know what. Because I knew he couldn't stop that automatic thing that was going. There's no way in the world that's going to stop. No way. So he just asked me, he told me what it, just explained the project again, because he's very good. Like he called me with the first tour. He explained what it was, who it was with, who was in the band, how it was going to, you know, he gives me the details. So he did the same with this. It's going to be quiet. It's going to be like secret. If you don't think you can handle that, then let me know. He was looking for a place. He was looking for the right studio because, he didn't want it to be leaked no matter what. And his reasoning for that was because he was fed up with the internet, which we all are now, being this place where you can't do anything in privacy anymore. especially in terms of releasing music. Because at that time, there was even more pirating and stuff. Like there seemed to be, if I recall, a little bit more of like, you know, somebody was doing a record and then suddenly it got out. And then once it's out, it's out. You can't re-release it and sell it because it's out. And it spreads around like wildfire. You know, instantly it's just out. And people were losing songs apparently. Like, you know, people that worked in a studio, I guess, would get a, you know, a zip drive or whatever they get, a file or a thumbnail or whatever, I don't know, whatever, and they would leak it. You know, it could be a tape op or, I don't use tape, but I don't know what you call them now. You know, computer op. Stealing, so, you know, who knows, but things would get out. So he said, I don't want people to get this music until like in the old days, you go and make a record. Nobody, you know, knows you're in the studio really making a record unless you want to talk about it. But most artists in the 70s and stuff didn't. They just do their album and all of a sudden there was like this brand new single by the Eagles, you know, and then it's out. You know, and you weren't wondering what the Eagles were doing or with, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he wanted to recreate, he just didn't want any preconceived, especially because he had taken a long time and he had been sick beforehand and he wasn't going to talk about that. Like he didn't come out of his, whatever his medical thing was and do a whole press thing and do a reality show or whatever. You know, he didn't do all that. He wasn't into all that. So he was into his privacy and he wanted the record, the music to be received in that way. He didn't want people to, if they knew he was making a record, they would already start writing about it. Somebody would have an opinion about what kind of record it was. Someone would say what they think he should do. Someone would say what they think he shouldn't do. Someone would have a, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, and everybody be talking about this record and waiting for this record. And then they'd be waiting for him to leak a little bit of the record. And then there'd be people at the studio. And then they would be asking people, are you on the record? They'd probably be calling me, you know, it was all these things would have happened. And he was right. They wouldn't. And he didn't want it. And that was the reason. And he was adamant about it. And if you weren't on board, and I think we did have to sign something, because if we leaked it out, we were screwed.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
It was big. And I appreciated it because I'm like him. I like my privacy. I'm having a really hard time in the world right now without it. But because it's taken, I feel like it's being taken away in every aspect of my life in so many ways. So I get it. You know, it's difficult. And he craved that more than anything. He wanted to just be normal in that way, like have his own thing that wasn't a public thing at all times, like a lot of people enjoy. So that was how that started. And then I complied. I said, yes, I will be. I didn't tell any. You couldn't tell your mother, your partner, your lover, your whoever. Nobody, your dog. Nobody could know. And so I had one friend who knew, one friend. And I said, I'm going to ask you, can I tell one friend? And I know she's not going to say a darn word. And he knew her because he had invited her. She used to hang out with us in the early days. And that's my best friend, Sarah Lee, who's also a bass player with the B-52s and Gang of Four. She's on Love Shack and Indigo Girls, Galileo, all that. She lives up here. We've been friends for like 30, almost 40 years. So Sarah knew. And he liked her. She loved when she came around. I think it's because she's a Brit. He liked his Brits. So they would get all British, you know, together. And he was very kind to her. So I said, you know, I'm going to need somebody to bring me down to the studio. And I don't want to use the car service. They can't know either. Like I used to use a car service. You know, nobody could know where I was going or what I was doing. So I made up a story that I was in the city for 2 weeks working with an artist that didn't exist. And I knew nobody was going to look him up because I said, it's just new, it's some new artist in Sweden. I don't know. They got some money. You know, I made up, as I said, they have some money and, you know, they can put me up for 2 weeks and I'm going down to the city and work on this record and I'll be back. Nobody blinked an eyelash. No one looked it up or cared, really. So it was perfect. I was holding my breath. They don't ask me who it is. So Sarah knew, and I said, Sarah, will you drive me down so I can take my basses and my pedals and all the things I needed for the work, for the session? I had to take a few different basses because I never knew what was coming. I had no idea what I was going to play. So I had to take a fretless and a five string and a four string and, you know, flat wound and round wound. And I had, you know, six basses or whatever with me.
Wow.
And a bunch of pedals and everything. I knew they had amps there. So I went down and she dropped me off. So she knew where I was. And she was cool, and she picked me up when it was over. And that's it. And that's how. And every day he came in, he had charts. They had been working on stuff. So for me, I usually come in when things are pretty much together. I'm just going to add the bass part. This time, there were some parts that were like Tony, because he was a bass player. Normally, he's the one playing on the records with somebody else. But Tony had written out some things. I don't read very well, but I could, once I learned what they were, I could just play them. I could kind of see what was happening on the page, but it was only certain little fills that made sense in the music. I can't tell you what they are now. I don't remember. But otherwise I was again up to interpretation. He had a basic setup. There was some chords. He had a little piano and a little setup at a piano where he was playing his demos for us so you could hear what he'd been doing at home. And then we take it away and rehash it and say, well, how can we embellish it? I see where you're going. Okay, let's see what we work out. It's like we normally would work with him. He'd bring in a really rough idea, but he knew what he wanted. He knew what we were going to give him, I guess, you know, and we did. We made him. He had that happy look on his face that you like to see when you look through the thing. You're like, oh, thank God, he's smiling. And he's dancing. Oh, he's dancing. Yeah. Oh, he's off the sofa. Oh, my God, I really hit it. It's true. Those were definite moments. I remember him. I could see him in his bedroom slippers. He'd come in and he'd put on his little slippers and get normal, put his glasses on. Total normal person, just creating music, just working, loving it, enjoying it, happy, smiling, joking. Drinking lots of coffee and used to be smoking, and I was right with him, but we quit right around the same time when his daughter was born. I've been smoke free ever since, thank God. So that was how that came about. And then I'm not on the whole album only because when I left, there were more songs to do, but I couldn't get back because I couldn't tell anybody where I was going and I was busy.
Oh, yeah.
And so he called Tony Levin. He called Tony Levin, which is fine. He's my neighbor and I love Tony. he lived across the street from me until a couple of years ago. So that was great. And he used to bring in the ideas, like he had some sheet music that he had brought out, maybe with words. I can't remember what was on it, because what happened was he'd come in with a little briefcase at the beginning of the day in his little Apple cap, his little baseball cap or whatever. And he'd come in and he'd open up this little briefcase and he'd put the music on the stands where we were all stationed. We all had our little stations. And then at the end of the day, he'd come and rip it off, but he'd do it really dramatically. That's funny. He'd come around and he'd snatch the paper off and he'd put in his, you know, his little dossier, like, ah, you'll never get them, you know. It was pretty funny. And that was the ritual every day. He took everything home, everything, hard drives, everything at the end of the day. He was adamant that nobody was going to screw him with this. And then it was done. And I heard nothing, because I was like, I wondered if he would ever put it out.
Wow.
This was 2 years between when I did all that.
Oh, I didn't
and
know it was
like,
that long.
I never mentioned it again. I never mentioned it to anybody in 2 years. And there's no way in the world. I was like, it was a Swedish artist. I don't remember his name. He didn't do very well.
Right.
But I got paid. So... And then all of a sudden, I can remember it like clockwork. I was listening to WDST radio, or Woodstock, and the clock radio goes off at 9 or whatever time it was going off every morning. I listened to Greg Patine. And the radio went off, and then I lay there for a minute, and all of a sudden, I hear them say, there's a new Bowie single that's just come out, and it's just come out this minute. And I was like, oh, you know, my heart stopped. I was like, oh my God. And it was Where Are We Now with Tony.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, because that was one song I didn't know, because I didn't get to do that one. There were a few, but I played on a good amount of those songs. I can't remember now. And then they did a deluxe version after the first original version. And then there was another batch of like 3 or 4 songs I was on. That are on that, like the one with the UFO, I forget what it's called. I can't remember the names now. God, I gotta pull that record out. Yeah, so that's how that kind of came about and what happened with that for me anyway. And I didn't know about Black Star. I had no idea. He did it again, and I had no idea. I knew I had a little bit of an idea because somebody knew something that he was working on something, and I think someone mentioned the word jazz or something, and then I just thought, well, that makes sense, because we used to talk about Stan Kenton and stuff. He used to love Stan Kenton.
Ooh.
He introduced me to him. I liked jazz, but I didn't know his music that much, so we listened to that Tropicana album and stuff, and just really love it. And I knew that he said, one day I want to do something like this. And when he says, one day I want to, it means it's going to fucking happen. Unlike some people like myself, so I'm trying to learn how that magic works. I'm trying to, you know, make it. I'm like, one day I'm going to, hey, is anybody listening? Anyway, so he says, one day I'm going to make a jazz record. I really want to do that, you know. And a long time ago, we talked about Mingus as one of, he's
ooh,
like my favorite bass
yeah.
player of all time. And that's his favorite jazz on. We discovered that. So we would just Mingus out sometimes and have like Mingus days. I used to go and visit him sometimes and listen to records. He had a little space where he had vinyl and stuff. It was great. And so he made Black Star, which was involved Donnie McCaslin and a more jazzier thing that made sense. It's kind of like Stan Kenton, but everything he did, he always put the Bowie spin on it, from Earthling to, you know, to the Black Star. Like if he's doing jazz or if he's doing funk or like Let's Dance or whatever, it's still got a thing from him that's what makes it. I don't know. And that's undescribable to me as well. You know, how does he take these genres that he loves and twist them just ever so slightly that it becomes him? And you're not thinking, oh, it's just it's someone making a jazz record. You know, it's different. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's
some artists try, like, you know, I'm trying to bridge that myself with some new work that I'm trying to work on. You know, I'm trying to pull together. It's like I want to do something from a particular genre, but I don't want it to be retro. It's not like I'm making a record of that genre. I'm making a record of now, because now is now. But that is a huge influence of something from that energy I want to incorporate with my own energy. And how that meshes together is sometimes a mystery. Sometimes it just falls together, and other times. But for him, I feel like it was something that was just, it always worked. He knew just how to turn that tap, you know, how to just what mixtures of, you know, to put in the bowl and stir it up, and it was always the perfect mixture. You know, it always tastes perfect. and it tastes like him. You know, it was Bowie's. It was Bowie's pancake mix. Nobody else's. You know. So, yeah. So I was very surprised when he passed away. It was awful. It was awful. That was an awful year. I thought that, yeah. Last year's pretty awful, but that was awful too. 2016 was a bad omen of something, I felt, in some way.
No, not one for the books, no.
Not at all. We lost so many incredible people, and him especially was such a surprise. Yeah, I hadn't seen him that year. And I had an email from him that was kind of strange, close to the time that he passed away. Now it makes sense, but it didn't. Not that it didn't make sense, but I was like, oh, that's a nice email, like, out of nowhere. I appreciate that. You know, it was kind of like just a hello, I love you kind of email. Like, and I just thought, it's not a usual thing. He's not a sentimental kind of guy in that way that I think of. He's a sweet man and very kind and one of the most respectful people I've ever met. Like, especially someone in his position that sometimes can. Or thinks they can afford to not be so respectful. Right. I should put it that way, you know. But he was just so kind and sweet. But he wasn't a mushy guy, you know. He didn't want you to get mushy. He didn't. That was a British thing, I guess. You know, oh, come on, stiff up a bit, make a cup of tea. You know, it's like, I don't want to go there. Let's not get too sentimental about things. So I had a little bit of a sentimental email from him before he passed, which was interesting.
That must be really nice to have now, just as a
oh yeah,
a goodbye.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Gail, it has been such a tremendous honor speaking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time. But before I let you go, I'm dying to see you play live, but we're speaking in late winter 2021 when the live music industry is obviously shut down. How can people see the work that you're doing at the moment when they can't see you on the stage?
Oh, I would love people to check out my Patreon page, if possible. It's brand new now, pretty much. I've just gone through our first month in February, and I'm just gearing up for the second month. So I'm still finding my footing. It's obviously, this is such a new adjustment for everybody in the world, trying to remain creative in the digital world and the virtual world, or I'm not sure what it's really called at this point,
right,
but I'm doing some, you know, really, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but we all know what I'm talking about, I think. And I'm doing this Patreon thing, which is a subscriber service. And right now I'm not doing my own music on it, but I will be eventually. I'm just trying to set up a system to give some people some nice stories, some exclusives, some photographs, share some of my photographs and videos that I've made that you won't see anywhere else other than Patreon if you subscribe. I'm giving myself a challenge, which is part of my regimen of rebuilding myself as a solo artist, is that once a month on Patreon, I'm giving a cover tune. I'm announcing an artist at the end of the month, and then for the following month, I'm going to record a song by that artist, so you get to vote on which song you like to hear me cover.
Oh,
and I'm just sort of doing it all on my own at my home studio. So it's not like a professional recording. Maybe it might be one day. But I've just delivered the first song, which was Paul Williams was the first artist, one of my favorite songwriters. And I did I Won't Last a Day Without You. So that's where you can find me. And also on Instagram, Gail Ann Dorsey Music. And on Facebook, which I also have a music fan page under Gail Ann Dorsey Music. And I think Twitter as well. I don't use Twitter so much. I don't quite understand it. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to sound like an old fogey here, but Twitter I don't get. But I'm good with Instagram and Facebook, kind of. But Instagram I enjoy, and I'm there occasionally. I'm trying to be there a little more, but now most of my attention is Patreon. So I would hope people would check it out if they're interested in seeing what I'm doing in the future, because I am working on some new music for a solo venture. Patreon.com.
Well, we will check it out there, and we hopefully very, very soon we will see you on the stage in front of us. No yes. screens.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.